Chapter 16. Death. Death may well be the only supernatural entity, strictly speaking, an anthropomorphic personification, which is known and acknowledged throughout the entire multiverse. His arrival is quite certain, and yet most people secretly hope that for them and their friends it will be indefinitely delayed, and his actual manifestation generally comes as a surprise. On the Discworld, only wizards and witches can foresee his arrival. On Earth, only exceptionally holy men and women. Some people try to bargain with him, staking lives on the outcome of a game of chess or cards. This rarely succeeds, though Granny Weatherwax did once win against him at Cripple Mr. Onion. Of course, he knew she would. Others try to run away. This is quite hopeless, since Death keeps an appointments diary and knows precisely where and when he is scheduled to find them. A story is told about this on our world. It is part of the age-old traditions of Muslim lands and reached English-speaking countries in the 1930s through a play by Somerset Maugham and a novel by John O'Hara. It tells of a servant who was buying food for his master's household in the street market in Baghdad one morning when someone jostled him, and he turned to find himself face to face with Death, who made an abrupt gesture. Terrified, the servant ran home, begged his master for the loan of a horse, and galloped off to Samara, which is about 75 miles away. The master then went to the marketplace himself, and there he too saw Death. "Why did you raise your hand to threaten my servant?" said he.
"That was no threat," answered Death. "Only a start of surprise. I was astonished to see him here in Baghdad, for I have an appointment with him tonight in Samara."
Something similar happened once on the disc, as we learn from The Colour of Magic, when Rincewind jostled a tall, dark figure in the bazaar of Ankh Morpork and was told,
"I was expecting to meet thee in Cephalopolis."
Actually, it turned out to be a misunderstanding. On both the disc and the earth, Death manifests himself to humans and humanoid races, e.g. dwarfs, as a very tall human skeleton, every bone pleasantly polished, with remote but piercing points of blue light in his eye sockets. His deep, resonant voice has been compared to many things of a funereal nature, such as the clang of the leaden doors of a crypt when slammed deep underground. Yet no comparison really does it justice. He wears a hooded robe woven of absolute darkness. Normally he carries a scythe, but also owns a sword for use on kings. Both weapons have shimmering, semi-transparent ice-blue blades for separating souls from bodies. There is usually an hourglass hidden in the folds of his robe. This is a lifetimer, which measures the lifespan of the person he is about to visit. On Earth, there are some countries in whose languages death is a feminine word, la mort, morte, muerta. This has no effect at all on the manifested appearance of death in those lands. In any case, it takes a calm, well-trained eye to tell a male from a female skeleton, and black hooded robes are unisex attire. There was a time when Death thought it polite to appear in whatever form the client expected, at least for human clients. What shape he assumes when manifesting himself to, say, a sea anemone, a mayfly, or a nettle, is beyond conjecture. However, he discovered that most people have no clear expectations at all, probably because in their hearts they never really believe they will die, and those who do think they know what they will see have some pretty strange ideas. For example, King Tepesimon the 27th, Pharaoh of Jellybaby, found that the hooded robe lacked a certain something.
"I understood that Death came as a three-headed giant scarab beetle," said the king.
Death shrugged. "Well, now you know."
"What's that thing in your hand?"
"This? It's a scythe."
"Strange-looking object, isn't it?" said the pharaoh. "I thought Death carried the flail of mercy and the reaping hook of justice."
Death appeared to think about this.
What in? He said.
Pardon?
Are we still talking about a giant beetle?
Ah, in his mandibles, I suppose, but I think he's got arms in one of the frescoes in the palace. Seems a bit silly, really, now I come to tell someone. I mean a giant beetle with arms, and the head of an ibis, I seem to recall.
From Pyramids.
There have been times and places on Earth where Death would have found it just as tricky to fit in with his local image. For the ancient Egyptians, he would have had to appear as Anubis, a man with the head of a jackal or wild dog. For certain South American peoples, as a cross between a jaguar and an eagle. For some Hindus, as the ferocious many-armed goddess Kali, adorned with garlands of skulls. So he decided to stick to what he liked best, using the costume and attributes he had been gradually collecting over the past 2,000 years or so. His starting point was the Bible, specifically the 6th chapter of the Apocalypse, or Book of Revelation, which speaks of a rider on a pale horse, whose name was Death, wearing a crown and flourishing a sword. The same passage mentions three other riders as his companions, War, Famine, and Pestilence. On the Discworld too, in suitable circumstances, he teams up with them, and they appear together as the four horsemen of the Apocalypse, as a sure sign that the world is just about to end. Probably. Some of their doings on the disc are recorded in The Light Fantastic, Sorcery, Interesting Times, and Thief of Time, and on Earth in Good Omens. Death liked the idea of a horse, and got himself a handsome white steed named Binky, who is real flesh and blood, though capable of galloping in the air and across the dimensions, as well as on land. He did briefly experiment with skeletal horses, but found bits kept dropping off, and fiery horses, which tended to burn down the stable. Binky is far more practical, and more reliable. He is well-fed and well-groomed. Death strongly disapproves of artists who represent the pale horse as a mangy, starving creature. From time to time, he requires new horseshoes, and on these occasions, Death takes him to the best farrier on the disc, Jason Ogg of Lancrey. Jason's gift as a craftsman is that he can shoe anything, anything that anyone brings him. A horse, a goose, a unicorn, an ant. But the price to be paid for the gift is that he must shoe anything anyone brings. So on certain nights, when he hears a certain knock and a certain voice, he does as his father and grandfather did before him. He puts on a blindfold and shoes what must, from the feel of it, be the finest horse in the world, and certainly the most docile. As far as is known, Death has not made similar arrangements on Earth, but apparently the devil did once. It's said that there was once a blacksmith at Keenthorn in Shropshire who was so proud of his skill that he boasted that if the devil himself came to his forge, he would shoe his horse for him, aye, and shoe him to rights too. And then, one dark midnight, a traveller on a great black horse arrived, demanding that it be shod. And the smith noted with horror that the rider himself had a hoof. The smith ran off in a panic and roused the parson, begging him for help. The parson answered that he must fulfil his boast, but should accept no payment, for that would be selling himself to the devil. So the smith did shoe the devil's horse most efficiently, but though the devil repeatedly offered him good payment, he would take nothing. The devil and his horse vanished in a flash of fire. To return to Death. In the course of the Middle Ages, he became dissatisfied with the idea of himself as the crowned and sword-wielding rider of the pale horse. He disliked the idea of kingship, even though it appealed to many artists and poets. To Milton, for example, who in Paradise Lost describes Death as a dark, faceless, but menacing shadow. What seemed his head, the likeness of a kingly crown had on. On one occasion on the Discworld, Death, who at the time had become more or less human and was calling himself Bill Dore, encountered an entity which had taken on his role, and had adopted much the same wraith-like manifestation as Milton described. This filled him with fury. The new Death raised his cowl. There was no face there. There was not even a skull. Smoke curled formlessly between the robe and a golden crown. Bill Dorr raised himself on his elbows.
A crown? His voice shook with rage. I never wore a crown.
You never wanted to rule.
From Reaper Man. And so Death went looking for another image from our world. He decided he liked the look of Old Father Time, an old man carrying a scythe and an hourglass. This figure had evolved out of a god called Cronus in ancient Greece and Saturn in Rome, who carried a sickle or a scythe because he was a god of agriculture, and an hourglass because he had also become the god of time. This happened because Cronus sounds almost exactly like Kronos, meaning time in Greek. Now, harvesting and death are two faces of the same thing, depending on the point of view. If you are the farmer reaping corn or grass, you're looking ahead to the bread, the beer, the hay for the cattle, and you go home for a cheery harvest supper, with plenty of drink and a hey nonny no, and maybe a barn dance. But if you are the plant being reaped, what you're going through is death. Seeing the sense in this, Death copied the scythe and hourglass of Cronus, and adopted the title of the Grim Reaper. It was, after all, his job to separate the wheat germ of the soul from the chaff of the mortal body. Both the rider and the reaper were thought of at first as having the normal body of a living man. However, the European Middle Ages had a rather morbid interest in physical decay. So for a while, Death adopted the appearance of a rotting corpse, with split belly, peeling skin and crawling worms, wearing, if anything, a shroud. Many medieval painters and sculptors showed him in this form. Then little by little, he changed over to something more hygienic, just clean, gleaming bones. His new idea of himself as a skeleton reaper seeped into the minds of Italian artists during the 14th century. He can be seen in this guise, for example, on early packs of tarot cards. He is number 13 among the great trumps, which accounts for a lot. Then, soon after 1400, painters in the Netherlands, who had to do the illustrations for manuscripts of the Apocalypse, got the message and started drawing the rider on the pale horse as a skeleton too. At first, they kept the sword. After all, that's what the book said. But by the end of the century, woodcuts in German Bibles were giving him the scythe instead. And that, give or take a black cloak and hood, is how Death still usually chooses to be seen. A skeleton on a white horse with a scythe and an hourglass. He allows himself one touch of luxury. The robe is fastened with a silver brooch engraved with an omega, which is the last letter of the Greek alphabet, and so very definitely signals the end. Also, it's a pretty shape. It was also towards the end of the European Middle Ages that Death learned how to dance. He is famed for it. Any dance, every dance. Square dances, round dances, reels, the polka, the mazurka, the waltz, the tango, the Quirmish bull dance. Allez! A high-speed fusillade of hollow, snapping noises suddenly kept time with the music.
Who's playing the maracas?
Death grinned.
Maracas? I don't need maracas.
From Reaper Man. That was on the disc. He can be just as energetic on Earth, too, judging by old prints of skeletons wildly leaping about, and by a story told in Sussex in the 1860s, as recorded by Charlotte Latham. There stood upon the downs, close to Broadwater, an old oak tree, and people said that always on Midsummer Eve, just at midnight, a number of skeletons started up from its roots and, joining hands, danced round it till cockcrow, then as suddenly sank down again. They said several persons had actually seen this dance of death. One young man in particular, having been detained by business at Findon till very late, and forgetting that it was Midsummer Eve, had been frightened out of his very senses by seeing the dead men caper to the rattling of their own bones. On other occasions, his dancing is sedate and courtly. In Europe in the 15th and 16th centuries, the dance of death was often painted on the walls of cemeteries and churches. It showed a line of men and skeletons, hand in hand, pacing along in a slow and stately chain dance. In England, there was a famous mural in the cloister of London's old St. Paul's Cathedral, the one that burned down in the Great Fire of 1666, and there is still a set of carvings on the ceiling of Roslyn Chapel near Edinburgh. The dance was also painted in the margins of prayer books and acted out in religious pageants. Nowadays, it is best remembered as the closing shot of Ingmar Bergman's film, The Seventh Seal. On the Discworld, Death has often tried to act in human ways, as a relief from his unremitting memory of both past and future, but he rarely gets much satisfaction from it. Fishing, gambling, getting drunk, and joining the Clatchian Foreign Legion in order to forget have not really worked for him. His greatest success was his spell as a farm labourer, harvesting a speciality, as described in Reaper Man. He also, on one occasion, enjoyed riding a rather special motorbike. There were two small cartwheels, one behind the other, with a saddle in between them. In front of the saddle was a pipe with a complicated double curve in it, so that someone sitting in the saddle would be able to get a grip. The rest was junk. Bones and tree branches and a jackdaw's bouquet of gewgaws. A horse's skull was strapped over the front wheel, and feathers and beads hung from every point. From Soul Music. Death is clearly the patron saint of album covers. And in some cultures, a saint is just what he is, or rather she is. Santa Muerta, a female folk saint. Devotees say she is an offshoot of the Catholic Church. The Church dismisses them as a cult. The case continues, but one follower delivered a quote with a near Discworld pragmatism, "It's better to make her your friend." Perhaps she recalled the words of St. Francis, "By your holy death, help us to live each day as our last, and to welcome Sister Death." Sainted or otherwise, Death is attracted to Mexico, where he takes part in all kinds of human activities, expertly and with great enjoyment. This is especially obvious around the time of the Day of the Dead, the 1st and 2nd of November. At this season, streets and shops are full of cheerful images of male and female deaths, not just dancing, but playing all kinds of musical instruments, flirting, fighting, drinking, showing off their fine clothes, working at any and every trade. Nothing, in short, could be more alive than death in Mexico. And what of the dead themselves on the Discworld? What happens when death comes to them? Well, that usually seems to be up to them. The only group who had no say in the matter were the luckless pharaohs of Jelly Baby. Mummified and immured in pyramids, which were supposed to ensure a blissful afterlife, but which simply imprisoned them inside a time distortion. After centuries of excruciating boredom, they broke free and passed over into death's world, with great relief, and forming an orderly queue. It is not known whether the ancient Egyptian pyramids had the same unwelcome side effect on their pharaohs. On Earth, according to the myths of ancient Greece, the gods would occasionally, as a mark of great favour, take someone newly dead and turn him or her into stars. The hero Perseus is a constellation now, as is Andromeda, the girl he rescued from a sea monster, and indeed Cetus, the monster too. So is Orion the hunter, lover of at least two goddesses. So is Almathea the goat, who became the constellation Capricorn. Some people on the disk are aware of this possibility, though as far as is known, the disk gods have never actually done it. Cohen and his horde rode for the stars because they wanted to, and gods had nothing to do with it. In any case, becoming a constellation is not a permanent solution. Mrs. McGarry looked up at the stars.
In the olden days, she said, when a hero had been really heroic, the gods would put them up in the stars.
The heavens change, said Death. What today looks like a mighty hunter may look like a teacup in 100 years' time.
From the Last Hero. There are a few who, when death comes to them, refuse to move on, preferring to become ghosts. Certain kings of Lancrey who haunt their ancestral castle, for example, and dwarfs who may choose to walk the earth in torment if they have not been buried with their finest weapons. According to the myths and folklore of our world, such situations are pretty common here. People linger as ghosts because they have not been properly buried, or have been particularly wicked, or have died by violence, or are looking for money they buried, or simply can't bear to leave home. But nobody in any universe can match the obstinacy of the political activist Reg Hsu, who insists on remaining a zombie in order to campaign for the rights of the dead and the undead. The normal course of events is that death escorts those who die to the edge of a vast desert of black sand, under a brilliant starry sky, where he informs them that what they do next, or what happens to them next, is not his responsibility. For in the universe of the Discworld, death is never the supreme reality. It appears that no two people have the same experience, since it will accurately reflect the beliefs and personality of each one. In Small Gods, for instance, 5 deaths are described. 1, a sea captain who believes that the souls of sailors become friendly porpoises, in British law it would be seagulls, sails away in search of paradise in a ghostly ship, for ships too have a soul, with a ghostly crew and ghostly rats, and an escort of ghostly porpoises. The 2nd and 3rd are soldiers. Fryett, an Omnian general, who secretly disbelieves the hellfire doctrines of that church, and Iklos, a private, who has never given much thought to religion. Both remember a childhood song. You have to walk a lonesome desert. You have to walk it all alone. Fryett asks Death, what is at the end of the desert? And is told,
judgment.
The memory stole over him. A desert is what you think it is, and now you can think clearly. There were no lies here. All fancies fled away. That's what happened in all deserts. It was just you and what you believed. What have I always believed? That on the whole, and by and large, if a man lived properly, not according to what any priest said, but according to what seemed decent and honest inside, then it would, at the end, more or less, turn out all right. You couldn't get that on a banner, but the desert looked better already. Fryett set out. It is the same for Iklos, though he puts it more simply. My mum told me about this, he said. When you're dead, you have to walk a desert, and you see everything properly, she said, and remember everything right. Death studiously did nothing to indicate his feelings either way. Might meet a few friends on the way, eh? Said the soldier.
Possibly.
Iklos set out. On the whole, he thought, it could have been worse. The next who dies is Vorbis, the single-minded, pitiless, utterly unshakable Omnian Exquisitor. When he sees the desert, his certainties drain away. Though he has taken for granted that there would indeed be a judgment, according to the rules of his religion, and that he would do very well in it, all he can feel is the echo of his own thoughts, and when he looks inside himself, all he can see is the horror of what he has done, and the terror of emptiness and solitude. The last to die is the compassionate monk, Brutha. He too follows death to the black sand under the starry sky.
Ah, there really is a desert. Does everyone get this? Said Brutha.
Who knows?
And what is at the end of the desert?
Judgment.
Brutha considered this. Which end?
Death grinned and stepped aside. It's only natural to want to know what lies at the far end of the desert, but this, as Tiffany told the Hiver in A Hatful of Sky, is something no words can describe, which is why you have to cross the desert to find out. But before you can even begin, there is something important to be done. You must face and accept judgment, the judgment you pass on yourself in the light of clear self-knowledge and accurate memory. And that, as Brutha guessed, begins as soon as you die at this end of the desert. And then Brutha sees Vorbis, hunched on the sand, too paralyzed with fear to have even started the journey.
But Vorbis died 100 years ago.
Yes, he had to walk it all alone with himself, if he dared.
He's been here for 100 years?
Possibly not. Time is different here. It is more personal.
Ah, you mean 100 years can pass like a few seconds?
100 years can pass like infinity.
Whereupon Brutha, true to his own nature, offers companionship to Vorbis, and they set out to cross the desert together. It may come as a surprise to those whose notion of Christian teaching about the afterlife is based on, say, the famous Hellfire Sermon in James Joyce's Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, that what is described in Discworld terms in Small Gods is pretty well what many modern theologians say, at any rate as regards Brutha, Vorbis and Friet, though maybe not the ship's captain. Such teachers say that a lifetime's daily choices determine what we are at the moment of death, and that God's judgment consists in letting us see, accurately and fully, what we have chosen to become. He does not hurl punishments. Those who suffer, like Vorbis, do so because they have imprisoned themselves in their own evil. It is to be hoped that every Vorbis finds a compassionate Brutha. The same point emerges from the post-mortem experience of the brutal, murderous, but mentally subnormal thug, Mr. Tulip, in The Truth. Death makes him see the value of the many lives he had destroyed, and once he understood the truth about himself, he is filled with huge remorse and passes his own judgment on himself, saying he wishes he could go back in time to kill himself, before he could do such harm. But as that's impossible, he wants to spend the rest of his afterlife feeling really sorry. As Death notes, Tulip has something in him that could be better, given enough time. His purgatory is not harsh, since he has been taught to expect reincarnation. Reincarnation is what he gets, in a form agreeable to the best part of him, his love of good craftsmanship and beautiful antiques. He becomes a woodworm in a fine old desk. However, there is nothing good in the other thug, Mr. Pin, who puts his trust in a lucky potato, and whose remorse is simply pretense. He too reincarnates, but the outcome will not be pleasant. He becomes a potato, and is fried, since reincarnation enjoys a joke as much as the next philosophical hypothesis. But to Death, a nature like Mr. Pin's is no joke. Death sighed deeply.
Who knows what evil lurks in the heart of men?
The Death of Rats looked up.
Squeak,
he said. Death waved a hand dismissively.
Well, yes, obviously me, he said. I just wondered if there was anyone else.
From The Truth. One who may have answers to the questions that trouble Death's lonely mind, questions about goodness and evil and justice, is Azrael, his lord. On earth, Azrael is the name given in the traditions of Islam to the angel of death, whose name is nowhere mentioned in the Bible itself. Muslims say he is one of the great archangels, equal to Michael, Raphael, or Gabriel in rank, and greater than them in wisdom. His name is Arabic and means help of God.
But the nature of Azrael is best seen on the Discworld. He is known there as the Great Attractor, the death of the whole multiverse, the beginning and end of time. He is so vast that he can only be measured in terms of the speed of light, and whole galaxies are lost in his eyes. Our death, the death who harvests all lives on Earth and on the Discworld, is only a little death, and Azrael is his lord. And at the end of all stories, Azrael, who knows the secret, thinks,
I remember when all this will be again.
From the Reaper Man.